The Tom Woods Show, episode 518.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, if you're planning to buy gold, make sure you don't get ripped off. There are a lot of scams out there. So read Peter Schiff's report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off. You can read it for free through tomwoods.com/scams. Hi, everybody. It's Tom Woods. We are talking about money today, talking about the general subject, what has government done to our money? And the reason we're doing that, of course, that's a title of a great Murray Rothbard book. But the reason I'm doing that is that what I'm going to do today is share with you a talk I delivered at Liberty Fest Houston 2015, sponsored by the Harris County Libertarian Party. And what they did was they had a series of talks on what has government done to our, whether it was property, roads, water, agriculture, science, constitution, schools, police, etc. And I was the luncheon speaker, and I talked about what has government done to our money. And it's not just rehashing the Rothbard book, although I do go over the basic thesis of it, but it brings it up to date with a lot of more recent episodes in monetary history and what the government is up to when it's going after our money and why it wants to dominate the monetary system. I think you'll get something out of it, even if you've read that little book by Rothbard. So I'm going to start it right now, and I'm also going to include the question and answer session, because that's a lot of fun. You definitely won't want to miss out on that. But what I'm going to do for your convenience is I'm going to start the talk about 5 minutes of the way in, because I began by doing what I have been doing at some of my recent talks, giving away a free ebook by having people text a word to a certain number. So, for instance, you can text the word Bernie, the name Bernie, to 33444 and get my ebook, Bernie Sanders is Wrong. You can get that. So that's the sort of thing I was doing, and I don't want to bore you with that because you already know how to get those free ebooks. So we'll skip that, and we'll go right into the talk, and I really hope you enjoy it.
So there you go. You get two free things, and I haven't even started. Now, having said that, I feel less guilty telling you, by the way, I do also sell books for money. And it's a little tricky because my books are out there, and I'm in here, and I have to leave shortly after my panel. So maybe when Tom and Kathy Glass aren't looking, you could sneak out of this room in between and catch me out there. Because if I have to bring any of these home with me, my heart is going to be broken after lugging them through the airport. But the one in particular I want to tell you about is my newest one called Real Dissent, and the subtitle is A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. And this has... Oh, thank you. This is kind of what I've come to specialize in. A lot of times, ever since Ron Paul came onto the scene, one of the fashionable things to do if you write for Slate or Salon is to write articles about how terrible libertarians are and how stupid our philosophy is. So people would start sending me these articles. Right? They're trying to hurt my blood pressure and my heart health. They send me these articles. They say, Woods, we need you to smack this article down. So I actually kind of got good at this just through sheer repetition. So I have a whole section of this book where I take all those and I put them in one of the sections, all the smackdowns where I show you the kinds of arguments that I think are going to help and that will be successful for you. So that and many other things. The Fed is in here, nullification's in here. It's like a piece of my whole career, bits and pieces of it, are all combined in here. So if you think, how could I choose among the 12 Woods books, I don't want to say it's the greatest hits, but this is a good starting point. So there you go. And plus, no big publishing house got rich off this book. It's the first book I ever self-published, and it was a great experience. It's incredible what's available to us in this day and age. The fact that I could send you that free ebook and basically multiply the number of copies of that book in existence instantly when you just texted that word is a miracle to me. So, I beg your pardon?
Audiobook.
Oh, and I do have the audiobook. I actually read the audiobook. Because a lot of times people say, I love audiobooks and I love your books. I hate your audiobooks. Why is that? I say, why is that? And they say, because your audiobooks sound like they were read by a guy reading the instructions for operating a microwave oven. I don't know where the publisher gets these people. They never ask the author. Never. They assume the author is inept and can't read without stumbling. So I never even get a chance to do it. So I thought, well, doggone it, this is my own book. I'm publishing it. I'm going to read it. So I did. I did. So yeah, at TomWoodsAudio.com, you can get the audiobook for free. All right, I'm done giving things away for free. Now I'm going to do what I was paid to come here to do, which is talk to you about money. That makes good sense. So I'm supposed to talk to you in this short time about, now I think we maybe started a little late, so I don't know how that's going to work. So when Tom and Kathy are protesting that I have to stop, I'm going to just pretend I don't see them. I'm just going to keep on going, okay? I think I was supposed to tell the rest of you that and not put them in earshot. So I am going to follow a little bit the Rothbard narrative, but not completely. It's true that Rothbard has this book called What Has Government Done to Our Money? You can read it for free. I mean, it's just the world, it's the world of free, isn't it? You just type in, what has government done to our money? You'll get a link to that book for free. And there's a free audiobook online. It's incredible. You don't have to do anything. And I have to say, the internet makes me feel great and makes me feel terrible about humanity. It makes me feel great because we can all do this. We can all spread our ideas. We can have a huge audience. I posed a question to Bernie Sanders supporters on my Facebook page yesterday. As of this morning, it's been viewed by 468,000 people. Absolutely incredible. Not one of them could answer the question that I posed, of course. But this is amazing to me. But the reason it makes me feel bad is now, I mean, up to now, people had an excuse. Well, who has the time and the money to track down all the resources you would need to understand a free society? Now you have to click 3 times, pay no money, and you have all the resources in the world, and people still want to just go to the mall and get drunk. So, all right, I guess it's going to take a little more work than I thought. So let's start off with, I'm going to take, let's say 5 to 8 minutes, it may be even less, starting off from no money at all and building up to how we have a monetary system. So let's imagine there's no such thing as money, nobody's ever heard of money. You've probably all heard this analysis where we begin with barter, people just directly exchanging one thing for another. People still do that to this day. And some people probably do it to evade the tax man, although strictly speaking, you are supposed to report in-kind exchanges on your taxes. So don't forget to do that this year. Make sure you do that. If somebody is going to mow your lawn in exchange for you giving a piano lesson, you're supposed to tell them about that. All right. Well, anyway, that is how things begin. But you realize that that has obvious limitations, not only for the obvious reason that if the only thing you have to give is lawn mowing services, and the only thing you want is a scrambled egg, you have to find a scrambled egg owner who wants his lawn mowed, and vice versa. So it limits the number of exchanges that can be made that are satisfactory to everybody. But then also, I mean, think about what if the only thing you owned was your house, the only thing, and you want to buy the newspaper. Well, you don't want to have to give the whole house away for the newspaper, and just a piece of the house, here's like a half a shingle, isn't very useful to people, so that doesn't work either. So obviously this is an unsatisfactory system, and eventually just, you don't have to assume anything other than people's self-interest, that they want to improve their material condition, and they want the institutional setting in which that improvement is most likely to take place. They're going to figure out eventually that if we have a highly marketable good that we know everybody will want, that eases this situation a bit. So I acquire berries or shells or whatever it is, and I know that people want those things. Even if I don't want them, I know I can get what I want in exchange for them. So this is how we get money. Money is a medium of exchange. It is a thing that we use not in and of itself, but so that we can get other things. Typically, though, when you read this analysis, you are talking about something that starts off with some use value. So gold has use value. You can use it for industrial purposes. You can use it for jewelry. You can use it in all sorts of ostentatious ways. You can have a gold-plated sink on your private plane if you're a certain Republican presidential candidate I won't mention. You try and figure out which one I'm talking about. But you can use gold for those purposes. But primarily, people came to use it for exchange. And it became the most widely used medium of exchange, which made it money. Now, strictly speaking, that's not really quite true when it comes to U.S. history. We talk a lot about the gold standard in U.S. history, but that's actually a case of government intervention, where the government insisted that we're going to have this monometallic monetary system. Because actually, The primary standard that the ordinary people used was a silver standard. If you look in the U.S. Constitution, the word dollar is used. And by dollar, they did not mean whatever money the government may arbitrarily choose to call a dollar. The dollar had an actual meaning. It was an existing coin. It was the Spanish milled dollar that was in wide circulation in the colonies and then in the United States. So it was a silver coin that people used. But the same principle is in effect. Silver has various uses, but most people want silver simply because it can command other goods in exchange. So we get a generally accepted medium of exchange. So notice, in none of this process is a government necessary. Conceptually speaking, there's no reason for a government to be involved. People can get to this point just by figuring out, I need things, and the best way for me to get them is to use a marketable good. And you don't want to have 87 marketable goods. You want the most marketable good because that will allow you to make the most exchanges with the greatest number of people across the largest expanse of land. This comes about spontaneously. However, it's money after all, and the government is going to want a piece of this somehow. So little by little, the government is going to insinuate its way into this process. And it will do so in ways that at first seem harmless, so innocuous that the only people who might object to them are those of us in this room. And we would, of course, be told, now you paranoid libertarians, the government is just trying to do this for our convenience, and why won't you let... All right. But it turns out that we're always right, you know? And... Doggone it, I am getting so tired of being right. When I'm talking about disaster striking, let me be wrong once in a while. So the first thing would be, first they want to monopolize the mint, the service that actually creates the coins. All right, well, you think, eh, big deal, right? Then it'll be standardized and we'll all know that the coins are of good value. And all right, I guess I can go along with that. Then they start using, instead of just it being a gold ounce or a gold whatever, they start insinuating into the system the use of national names for the money. So I think of a dollar as a 20th of an ounce of gold. And so I start talking about dollars instead of gold. Now, there's nothing strictly wrong with that. It's not like that's an anti-free market in and of itself, but it gets people thinking in terms of national units instead of thinking in terms of an international money accepted everywhere by people all over the world. You think of the dollar as being some American thing, and so you begin to think of money as somehow emerging out of America or France or England. You associate it with a country instead of with a worldwide division of labor. Then, again, there's nothing strictly wrong with this either. The encouragement of the use of paper money substitutes. There's nothing wrong with using paper as a substitute for some precious metal standard. That if I find that more convenient to use paper, if the paper can be redeemed into the money commodity itself, there's nothing strictly wrong with that. But as people start to use the paper, they begin to think of the money as being the paper, as opposed to the paper being a substitute for the money. So in other words, these seemingly innocuous steps prepare the intellectual groundwork and the mental groundwork for people accepting the idea that money is pieces of paper that are in some way connected to my government. And you'll notice that when we started off just now, I explained to you the whole way money comes into existence has nothing to do with government at all. And when Ludwig von Mises wrote The Theory of Money and Credit that came out in 1912, he was fighting against this state theory of money, expressly in that book, that money comes about through the creation of the state. It doesn't. But we've come to think this way because of these underhanded steps that seemed so minor at the time. And then, of course, the final step is the doozy. And that's the one where the government finally takes the commodity backing away from the paper so that now you can't convert that paper into anything other than new pieces of paper, which you can go to the bank now and say, I have this old beat-up 20. Would you give me a fresh one? That's what they'll give you. They're not going to give you an ounce of gold, certainly for $20. You can forget about that. So the state takes away the gold or the silver or whatever it is and leaves the people with the paper, and its conquest of the monetary system is complete. Now, maybe this has had good results, though. Maybe there's no reason to complain about this. Maybe government has given us a monetary stability that we could not have had in the absence of government. People are laughing at that proposition. And people will say, look around, look around. Prices are not increasing very rapidly. Okay, I'll concede to you that it's true. According to the official measures, consumer goods are not increasing in price that fast at this particular moment. That is absolutely true. Of course, other classes of goods have seen their prices increase wildly during the same period of time, housing being a good example, and other financial assets being a very good example. But when we look through U.S. history, we look through the period from the early Republic all the way up through the early 20th century, we would not say that prices increased very slightly every year, which is what's happening now. We would say that prices decreased every year. So that's really what we should be aiming at, is prices falling. We shouldn't say, well, it's good that they're only rising at a slow pace. We should want them to fall. Now, that is what I've just said is terrible heresy from the point of view of monetary orthodoxy. We don't want prices to fall. Why, deflation is associated with depressions. No, it's not. I got a whole shebang about deflation in this book here, Meltdown, which I wrote on the financial crisis. This was a New York Times bestseller. You can tell the economy is in the toilet when a whole bunch of people want to read a book on the economy. Believe me, I have tried peddling such things in the past. And when things are doing well, don't bother me. I'm busy flipping my 12th house. Don't tell me what's wrong here. I have no job, and I'm paying interest only on all these houses. What could go wrong? Okay. Well, then they want to know what went wrong. Well, okay. Anyway, I've given whole talks on deflation. I have an episode of my show on deflation. Please tune into that, tomwoods.com. It's free. The tagline is become a smarter libertarian in 30 minutes a day. Monday's episode will be episode number 489. I am still thinking of what to do for episode 500. No, I'm not having Ron Paul on because that's what you'd all expect me to do. So no, it's got to be something surprising. Can't be Judge Napolitano because that's the second thing you'd expect me to do. So I don't know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll just have my next door neighbor on because you would never expect that. And Sheriff Mack is saying, what about me for episode 500? Okay, all right. We'll see. The show is a dictatorship, so we're just going to see. It's my arbitrary whim. All right, but on the deflation front, it's interesting to note that the best period that we've ever had in terms of economic growth in U.S. history was 1870 to 1914. That was a period when the savings rate was very high, so much for saving hurts the economy. You have to go out and spend. Oh, yeah? Well, then how come the best, most sustained period of economic growth, 4% annualized, occurred when savings were really high? Answer? Well, they give you no answer because they don't even know that. Or that was when we had a precious metal monetary standard, when supposedly you can't have economic growth under a monetary standard. We had the best growth ever in U.S. history. Nothing. No response. Prices are falling. Prices are falling. That's supposed to be impossible. Businesses can't be profitable if prices are falling. Yes, they can. Yes, they can, because they anticipate the falling prices. And when they anticipate the falling prices, they adjust the bids, the prices they're willing to pay for their inputs accordingly. That's what entrepreneurs do. They anticipate these things. They're okay. They are not delicate flowers who get discombobulated by price changes. That's part of their job, is to anticipate price changes. And no, it's not a bad thing for us to be able to buy more things every year. That's not bad. That's good. People say, well, if prices are falling, because they admit that prices do fall under our system and their crummy system, the best they can say is they're not rising that fast. And we're supposed to say, oh, wowee. Well, they used to fall all the time. And what they'll say is, well, if prices are falling, nobody will ever buy anything. That's the argument. I'm not kidding. No one will ever buy anything because as soon as you go to buy something, you say, it'll be cheaper tomorrow. I'll wait till then. Then tomorrow comes, you say, what do you think, I'm a sucker? I'll wait till tomorrow. It's going to be even cheaper. So apparently you go out for coffee. Somebody says, okay, yeah, that's 75 cents for the coffee. You say, what kind of a sucker you think I am? 3 months from now, it'll be 73 cents. So according to this model, we would all just be sitting on our deathbeds, and then finally we'd say, all right, I'll finally buy an iPod. Because think now, there's a huge sector of the U.S. economy where prices do fall, and we expect them to fall, and that's electronics, consumer electronics. And yet I bet everybody has a smartphone or a tablet or a laptop or a desktop computer, everybody in this room. Not one of you said, I'm never buying one because I'll be a sucker if I do because it'll be cheaper the next day. We all know it's going to be cheaper and it's going to be better. And the minute you buy that thing, you know you're a sucker. Like, you know it, but you need it. The countervailing effect is that you need the thing now. Like, why am I even having to argue this? Like, this is really bad that those are their arguments. All right. Now, in terms of prices, even when inflation of consumer prices is relatively low, the cumulative effect is very substantial, such that if you were to try to save for your retirement by simply piling up pieces of paper, Federal Reserve notes, by the time you got to retirement, they would lose 2/3 of their value. Even if they lose only a couple percent per year, that snowballs. And by the time you retire, you've lost a substantial chunk of that nest egg. It's gone. It's gone. What did people do before we had this system? Before we had this system, people could accumulate precious metal coins that circulated as money. Now, today, precious metal coins do not circulate as money unless you are an idiot, you want to spend a gold coin at its $50 an ounce face value. So it doesn't circulate as money. People buy them as hedges or as investments or, you know, for security, but they don't circulate as money. So they fluctuate a bit. What you're really seeing in precious metal money fluctuation is the money fluctuation of the paper money. But when precious metal coins circulated as money and they exchanged in every marketplace, hats, magazines, steak dinners, shoes, light bulbs, everything exchanged against money, their value increased over time. So all you needed to do for your retirement, if there even was such a thing in those days, was just accumulate the coins. Now, you could invest and you would get even more of a return. But all you had to do was just hold on to your hard-earned coins. They would at least hold and possibly increase their value. Today, you don't have that benefit anymore, thanks to what government has done to our money through its established monopoly institution, the central bank, which, by the way, was created by the U.S. Congress. So don't tell me that it's a private institution. Some private institution that has the president appointing its board and, you know, has all this bizarro features, has government-supplied monopoly privileges to create legal tender money out of thin air. There's no private institution that's allowed to do that. No, this is what government has done to our money. And now the average person can't just accumulate money and hope to retire. So what does the average person have to do? Become a speculator. The average person has to somehow go into the stock market or buy a mutual fund, like Dave Ramsey says, you know, which might have made sense in the year 2000. You're going to get a 12% annual return. Okay, how's that going? So, yeah, exactly. So what people have to do is throw their money into areas they know nothing about, just hoping they can just hold on to the purchasing power of what they've worked so hard to save. Government becomes more through this type of monetary system, because it can siphon off resources from the rest of us more surreptitiously than it could if it had to raise taxes or to borrow so heavily that it would raise interest rates and annoy people in that way. There's the moral hazard problem. The financial industry knows that there is this institution backstopping the whole system, the Federal Reserve, that has a monopoly power to create an unlimited amount of legal tender money out of thin air. Well, how do you think that affects the recklessness or wisdom of the investment and spending practices of these institutions? The question answers itself. So the very institution itself creates moral hazard. One study of 30 currencies showed that not a single case of a currency freely manipulated by its government or its central bank since the year 1700 had enjoyed price stability for at least a 30-year period. And then, of course, the system we have gives rise to the business cycle. And Mises talks about the business cycle. He was the real originator of the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Most of you in this room are familiar with that. And I mean, that basically what this book is about is taking the Austrian theory of the business cycle that Hayek won the Nobel Prize for and applying it to the most recent financial crisis to show that people like Peter Schiff were not just using tea leaves or a Ouija board, that's how they figured out that something was wrong. They understood what Mises taught and what Hayek and Rothbard and all these others taught, that you can't just treat interest rates like they're just arbitrary, meaningless numbers that you can manipulate because it seems like it would be more fun to have low interest rates. It'd be more fun to have low everything, low milk prices, low everything. But we know with milk prices, we immediately see the problem. You lower milk prices below the market rate, fewer people are going to supply milk and more are going to demand it, so you're going to have a shortage. You see that immediately. But when you tinker with interest rates, it's not immediately obvious what the effects will be. That's why we need the Misesian analysis, where he goes through and shows you that this causes a misallocation of resources all through society, all through the capital sector. There's a misallocation of resources because entrepreneurs are making investments they wouldn't have made otherwise. Because one of the questions you have to answer when you're going to spend your money is not just what am I spending it on, but how long is the process I'm spending it on going to take? So research and development can take decades to actually bear fruit. Building a new factory can take a little while. Building an extension on your retail store would take less time, whatever. There's a time dimension to investments. And interest rates are all about time. And if you interfere with interest rates, you're going to interfere with the decisions entrepreneurs make about time, time-based investments. They're going to make investments that don't match up with the real availability of resources. Now, I explain this step by step. I have had people tell me that this may be the best thing I've ever done in the sense that it's easy to get confused by what Mises is saying about the business cycle. But I sat down and I thought, why did I have trouble understanding this? And I want to explain it in a way that anticipates people's potential confusions. And I've had people say, I finally get it after reading Meltdown. So that I'm glad about. And that's, by the way, that's how when I was in high school, I was so good at explaining math to people. I would ask myself, what confused me about the way my teacher explained this? And if they had just explained it this other way, I would have gotten it instantly. I just teach it to them that other way, and they get it. And they would send me all the athletes who were getting booted off the team for their bad grades, and I would sit down with them and say, look, this is how I would explain it. And they would say, well, yeah, okay, I get it now. So that's one thing I can do. I don't always come up with a lot of fresh new ideas. I take the old ones and I explain them so that the way I would want them explained. So the business cycle that we see where the economy seems to be doing great and then badly and great and then badly, well, this is accentuated and indeed made possible by the existence of a Federal Reserve System that can influence interest rates through its ability to create legal tender money out of thin air and artificial credit and pump it into the system. You don't have that in a naturally occurring free market monetary system. Now, I've actually run into the complaint, if you can believe this, I've had somebody say to me, on my own blog no less, that the monetary system we have now is already the Austrian free market utopia. Now, these are the LaRouche people. The LaRouche people are right about 10% of things. And therefore, some unwary people kind of thought, let's let these people into the Ron Paul movement. Now, I'm all for big tents and everything, but at some point, you know, come on. I get these people saying George W. Bush was a free marketeer. That's Webster Tarpley's view, and I'm told I'm supposed to like Webster Tarpley, I'm supposed to go learn from him. If he thinks, first of all, that the Constitution, through the General Welfare Clause, authorizes national health care, George W. Bush was a free marketeer, and we had a free market on the eve of the financial crisis, I say three strikes and you're out, Webster. Okay, to that. So I went through, I just came up, here's my list of objections to that. Let's see, first we have a monopoly producer of money. Okay, that's not a free market. We have legal tender laws that artificially privilege the monopoly money. So that also not free market. We have an institution that has a mandate to manipulate the money supply, supposedly in the interest of maximizing output and minimizing unemployment and inflation. Well, that's central planning. That's not a free market. We have interest rates that are influenced by this monopoly monetary authority instead of by the free market. We have implicit and explicit bailout guarantees for large financial institutions. We have large financial institutions having artificially low borrowing costs because everybody knows they're going to be bailed out, so they can borrow much more cheaply because there's less risk associated with them. And then, of course, we have artificial protection of the whole system through the FDIC and the Federal Reserve itself. This is nothing even remotely close to what we favor. The most heavily regulated of all industries is the banking industry. And in fact, on the eve of the financial crisis, for those who say we just needed more regulation, that would have fixed it. Okay, we had on the state and federal levels 115 regulatory agencies for the financial sector. So we're supposed to believe, well, if we had had 116, that would have showed them. That's not reasonable. That's just not a reasonable position to hold. Now, when I opened last night with my own talk last night, I started off by saying, I don't want to just get up and say, things are terrible, thank you very much, see you tomorrow. Because, I've done plenty of that in my life. Yeah, of course we know about the problems. We already know about the problems. Now, when we're proselytizing for new people, sometimes to wake them up, you have to grab them with the problems. But after a while, people say, all right, I already know, you know, there's inflation of the money supply and it's instability and the business cycle. I'm right already. Like, I get it. What are we going to do? So I spent last night giving examples of things that either I've done in my niche or that people have done in their niches where they haven't just sat around complaining, they've done something new. So I talked about a physician who happens to belong to the Libertarian Party. He ran for lieutenant governor in Kansas, who doesn't use insurance and doesn't use Medicare or the government. He just simply cuts drug prices in his practice by 97% because he orders from the same place that Walmart orders, but he doesn't have any markup because he just wants you to use his service, which is $50 a month. You get all the services you want. And he's able to cut prices so low that you'd be crazy not to use this guy. He's solving the healthcare problem in Wichita, one man. Or I gave an example of somebody who started a new company, Praxis. I just featured him on my show at tomwoods.com, where he says, you know, instead of getting into debt $100,000 for 4 years, studying sociology, and then you get out, and it turns out there isn't really a market for sociologists after all, maybe there's an alternative to that. Answer, he comes up with his own company, where he's going to place you in a business that will give you real, not grunge work, but real business experience for a year. And in case after case, he's placing people in that business after that year is up, or in that industry, or they're starting their own business. These are things that we can actually do. Now, when it comes to money, it's true. There are things that people have tried to do, like Bitcoin and other alternatives. To me, the most important thing we can do with money right now is, though, education. Is alerting people to the problem. And I want to close by telling you about a project that I'm very excited about because I've been thinking about this for years, and we're finally going to make it happen at the end of the month. And if you opted in to get my free book, I'm going to send you, if you don't mind, a little note telling you when this thing is live. It should be September 30th of this year. Some of you know my very good friend Bob Murphy, and if you don't, you're in for a treat when you do meet him. He just moved to Houston, by the way, so obviously he knows a little something. You know he's a smart guy. He's a chief economist at the Institute for Energy Research, but he's got many, many credentials, not the least of which is he's the zombie in my zombie video. Yeah. Interview with a zombie. And now people recognize him. Yeah. Not for his economic work. And this drives him crazy, by the way. Like he's got a PhD in economics from NYU. He's very accomplished. You know, he's got all these great peer-reviewed articles. But he's typecast as a zombie now. And that's all people know about. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, jot down interviewwithazombie.com and you'll enjoy that little video. Well, anyway, Bob is the anti-Paul Krugman. There is nobody who knows more about what Paul Krugman has said in the past than Bob does. So anytime Krugman says something and criticizes other people for holding some view, Bob knows on December 12th, 2011, Krugman himself held that view. And then bang, he links to it. Awesome. Bob and I are going to do, now my show right now, tomwoods.com, the Tom Woods Show, I do that every single weekday. Monday through Friday, I release a new episode, some other aspect of the libertarian message, okay? I do that every day. This is going to be just weekly, once a week. The show is called Contra Krugman. Once a week, the show comes on and refutes Paul Krugman's New York Times column every single week until one of us dies. Now, people say, oh, why are you giving Krugman the attention? Hello, because he has millions of readers he's screwing up every single week. And because he is the public face of Keynesianism. He is, like it or not. And he's a jerk. It's not just that he disagrees with us. I mean, the way he treats other Keynesian economists is appalling. I've seen him quote somebody, use an ellipsis, where he takes out the key point and then says, I can't believe this guy doesn't get the key point. I mean, it's rotten the way he treats people. And he's also so vain on a personal level that this podcast will drive him insane. But what we're really doing is teaching economics. We're not just taking pot shots at Krugman. We're using him as a base from which to teach economics for free every single week. You can tune in and learn economics by believing the opposite of Krugman every week forever. Now, that's amazing that we can do this. And I am so thrilled about it. And I bought the domain name ContraKrugman.com. It was available. There's nothing up there yet. There'll be something in a couple of days. We got a nice video to get people to whet people's appetites about it. But that will also have another good effect. There are a lot of regular GOP, middle-of-the-road voters who don't like Paul Krugman. But, you know, if you told them about Ludwig von Mises, they wouldn't know. They would think you were talking about some symphony composer from three centuries. They don't know what in the world you're talking about. But they don't like Paul Krugman. And they'll never listen to my show. My show is not accessible enough for them because it takes a lot for granted. But they'll listen to this because they love the idea of sticking it to Krugman every week. So we will be not just preaching to the choir. We're going to train a gigantic choir is our goal. We're going to reach a lot of people we couldn't ordinarily reach by saying libertarian this, libertarian that. What we're saying is contra Krugman. There's a big tent for that. And once we get them in that tent, we zip up the entrances and we start teaching them the real stuff. I'm really excited about that. Stay tuned for that announcement. Come visit my book table and thank you very much.
All right, now it's time for the question and answer session. But before we get to that, a word from our sponsor. Here's some good advice. Be an informed consumer and don't get scammed. There's been a surge in physical demand for gold, and the conditions are ripe for scammers. Oh, buy collectible coins. Buy coins with numismatic value. Get a leveraged gold account. Get this price protection plan. They're scams, and Peter Schiff's free report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off, will help you avoid them. Schiff Gold, which is where I get all my own precious metals, is doing the public a tremendous service with this report. See, the trouble is the precious metals industry is an extremely low-margin one, so some dealers just can't resist the temptation to try to make it into a high-margin one at your expense. That's why you won't want to make any moves with regard to gold without checking out Peter Schiff's free report, which you can read at tomwoods.com/scams.
Let's pretend you're on the panel of our presidential candidates. What would be the three top libertarian questions you would ask the presidential candidate?
Of the Libertarian Party?
Yes.
Or of the Republican Party?
Candidate.
Oh, okay.
For the three top questions you would ask, libertarian questions you would ask of the presidential candidates.
And okay.
Don't flub it and forget the third one.
Okay, let's see. Don't flub it and what?
Forget the third one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and then have Mitt Romney help me out. Yeah, Mitt's just sticking that dagger in. Speaking of which, I just heard that he dropped out. Rick Perry just dropped out. Yeah, how about that? Because the field is so strong this year. Oh, my heavens. All right. What would my three questions be? All right, I guess my first one would be, almost everybody at this point admits that the war in Iraq was a big mistake and it was based on phony intelligence. But since a 7-year-old with an internet connection knew that, Why should we trust you when you only seem to be opposed to wars that have already occurred and where it's now popular to be against them? What possible reason would I ever have to trust you as commander-in-chief? That'd be my first one. I guess my second one would be... Second would have to do about the financial crisis. Now, I don't know anybody on this debate stage who had any the slightest clue there was a financial crisis coming. In fact, in 2012, we had Herman Cain, who 1 week before Fannie and Freddie collapsed, said the economy was really robust and anything to the contrary was a myth invented by the liberal media. Clueless. We had John McCain, who said, I don't know a lot about economics, but I have Alan Greenspan's book. Okay. Given that not one of you had any idea there was a financial crisis coming, whereas on the House floor in 2001, Ron Paul said, well, let's see, we just had the dot-com boom burst, which I predicted would happen, and now they're creating a housing bubble, and that's also going to burst. He predicted that to a T, and he predicted exactly how it was going to turn out. Why shouldn't we recruit him to be president, given that not one of you had the slightest idea what was going on? How can you fix something you're not even aware is happening? That'd be my second one. Third one would be, are you going to remove these restraints from my arms as you're dragging me out of the room for asking these first two questions?
Okay. We talked about Rick Perry dropping out, and that was we reported on that news in our first session. And you know, he said that there were three reasons he dropped out. One, he can't get into the debates. Two, the media won't cover him. And three,
what was it? The EPA?
Yeah,
that was
yeah,
Mitt
yeah,
Romney's
yeah.
answer.
Oh, that was the third one. It's it tomorrow. All right, one question you've answered.
Tom, my question is more general about the Liberty Movement as a whole. So I think, you know, Ron Paul's campaign a few years ago was monumental for the Liberty Movement, especially amongst college students, people in their early 20s. He, you know, saw his campaign as a large victory to mobilize a lot of people in that age demographic. Fortunately, since then, in my opinion, a lot of those minds have more sided with Bernie Sanders and some of the candidates who are throwing on the left. Those candidates and Ron Paul seem to have similar destination in mind, but the route that they choose to take to get there couldn't be any more different. So my question for you is, what is the Liberty Movement, you know, doing to kind of attain the momentum that, you know, occurred during the Ron Paul campaign to make sure we don't lose too many of these people who are in the Ron Paul over to the more Bernie Sanders side?
So the question is, we've had some people who were involved with Ron Paul's campaigns who are on the Bernie Sanders side of things. Now, if being for Bernie Sanders, Look, I put a whole book together on this. What can I say? But what's funny is the one area where you think he might be somewhat decent, it would be nice to see a Democratic analog of what Ron Paul did. It'd be nice to see Bernie call out his party for being a bunch of warmongers. But frankly, he's a coward on that issue. Not a word about Hillary. Not a word about Hillary. Period, as far as I can see. But certainly not a word about how she's a hawk, she's a disaster. There's a great, there's a woman named Diana Johnstone I'm going to have as a guest on my show next week, because she has a book called Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. That is the correct leftist view of Hillary, that she has been a disaster because she's intervened in all parts of the world that are all worse off now. And Sanders won't mention that. So I, on Twitter, got to follow me on social media, because I have fun with this stuff. On Twitter, I said, you know, how come boring Bernie Sanders isn't willing to take on Hillary on foreign policy? And so I used the hashtag feel the coward. And some guy responded, well, you know, he's trying to appeal to the working classes, and that would be a distraction. So, oh, boy, did I have fun with that. Yeah, oh, I'm so sorry about the mass murder I committed by mistake. That would be a bit of a distraction for us to be talking about. So I said, but that just goes to show. So he might be good, he can't even be bothered to speak up. So I could say if he was good on that, like really outspokenly good, then I could at least sort of understand slightly the instinct that draws you to him. But otherwise, the things where he's the somewhat good at, he never talks about. The things he's horrendous on, that's what he hammers home. It's the old Rothbard's law. Everybody concentrates in the area in which he's the worst. Well, here are the areas in which he's the worst, and that's what he talks about constantly. I would say my concern is not primarily how do we chase those people back, because I don't think we ever really had those people in the first place. My bigger concern is how do we get the people who really were dedicated to the ideas of Ron and the ideas that we love, but who got excited about it because it was a political season. And then the political season ended, and, well, it's not as exciting anymore. And they don't want to do the grunge work that we all do. They just fade away. I want to track those people down. I don't want to have to re-educate people who went over to Bernie Sanders. They were not in the movement. They must not have been in it. They should, you know, I did write this little book that maybe that'll do some good. I don't know, but the real question is how do we keep enthusiasm going? And the answer to that is it's really hard because now Ron didn't want to be a leader of a movement. That was obvious. He kept telling us, I'm not going to tell you guys what to do. I'm not going to organize you in any way. I'm just going to tell you, do what you think is best for you to do. And that's great, but from time to time, it would be nice for us to get together and have some direction as to what, so that we can coordinate our efforts so we're not duplicating efforts unnecessarily. And I think right now we're extremely splintered. The Rand Paul movement, as I knew would happen, first, well, there's one thing I didn't know would happen, one thing I did. First, it made Ron Paul people turn against each other. Now they're all bitter at each other. Some people say you should be supporting Rand, and others say Rand is horrible and he's giving us a bad name. And so people who were good friends now don't speak to each other anymore because of the Rand Paul. I knew that was going to happen. What I didn't know was that Rand would be such a non-entity in the campaign that he would be doing so badly that it almost doesn't matter. It actually hasn't caused as much damage as I thought because there's just no enthusiasm for him. I mean, if you saw a Ron Paul rally, the cheers were loud, there were thousands of people. But when I see a Rand Paul rally, by and large, I can hear every individual clap. That's not good. What's going on here? It's not working out. So we don't have a leader. So we have the Alex Jones people, and then we have Mises Institute-related people. We have Washington, D.C. libertarians. We have state-based groups. We have the Texans, who are an entity unto themselves. We have all these different groups. And I don't think there's any likelihood that any one of us is going to pledge allegiance to any one person. So the best we can do is each one of us, each group, find that issue that gets people excited. Maybe people don't get excited about libertarianism, but they do get excited about guns, or they get excited about property rights because something happened to them. We find those one issues, and that works better. My friend Michael Bolden, who started the 10th Amendment Center, he used to have these great events, Nullify Now, and it was all about nullification. And I love nullification. I wrote a book on it. I love it. But those events, he found, he would get a good crowd. But what works better is focusing on, here's a thing we should nullify. Because everybody, he could find everybody who hates that one area of government involvement. And we all want to nullify that. But they don't necessarily favor nullification as a general principle. But they do favor that one thing. And it's great to get to know other people on that one thing. Because once you do, maybe you can start them thinking about, well, if we don't want the government in this one thing, maybe there's some conclusion we can draw from this. And maybe that's how we build and we reach other people. Find the one thing, and then maybe that one thing becomes two. And once it becomes three or four, then they start saying, wait a minute, maybe you're right about everything. So there you go. Oh, and by the way, also young people. Start with young people. And I say that as a guy, you know, into middle age at this point. Once you get to my age, I'm 43, you don't change your mind. You do, but it's very rare. You want to reach people when they don't have a mind yet to change. If you catch my drift. All right, thanks. Thank you.
All right, what am I going to put on today's show notes page? That'll be tomwoods.com/518. Well, for one thing, I'll put a link to Rothbard's What Has Government Done to Our Money? Then I will link to any other books that I might have mentioned in this talk. Those will all be there at tomwoods.com/518. I will link to Contra Krugman because I mentioned that in the question period. Again, if there's anything else that might be of interest to you that I talked about here, I will try and link to it at tomwoods.com/518. Before I let you go for the weekend, remember, if you're thinking about starting a blog, I'll help kickstart it for you with some free publicity, plus a bunch of free video tutorials to get you up and running in just 5 minutes, and then after that, to make you into a real expert at blogging, if that's what you want to do. So to get all that stuff, just head over to tomwoods.com/publicity. We got some great stuff coming up next week. We're going to be talking about Norway, because we've done shows on Denmark and Sweden. These are the countries that we're all supposed to want to live like. Well, so we're going to do Norway next week. Plus, we're going to talk about the dark net. Ooh, that part of the internet that most of us square people, we don't know anything about, but we're going to learn about it next week. I mean, it's just one crazy, awesome episode after another. So I hope you'll join me. Have a good weekend.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.